This is Ann Smith, and I am at the Matheson House with Bob Gachet. And the Matheson House is the second oldest home in the county, second only to the Bailey
Barely,
House.
barely, right.
And we're here for the third session of his oral history, starting out with his experiences in World War II, and today's date is April 28th, 2009. And when we were talking about Iwo Jima, we were talking about when you arrived there, and I think we talked a little bit about the landing and maybe the first few hours. And we were going to talk some about the detail of what the daily life was like or what the nights were like. And you were going to explain a little bit more detail about that for us.
Okay. You've kind of given me a starting point there because
Well, I hope
I
so. We've
wasn't
had some
sure.
fits and starts, haven't we, with this?
Yes, we have. But we can pick up with some of the mentioned details and
And now tell me again. Now this is what month and what year?
okay, this is the month of February in 1945.
And so when you landed there, the weather was.
It was fair. It wasn't bad at all. The sun was shining. The waves weren't too high. They were enough to make some of the guys seasick.
Yes.
But it was not bad weather till later in the afternoon, later on, when the wind picked up and the waves got higher. But the weather overall wasn't bad at all. And it was clear and bright and deadly. I had to say that because there were dead young Marines on the beach,
All
and
over,
that was
yes.
the sad part about it.
And you mentioned having to take cover sometimes in a crater that maybe a mortar had fallen, so that they were 'cause they were firing down on you from above. Do I have that right?
Yes, exactly right. And from 540-foot Mount Suribachi, they had emplaced machine guns, they had emplaced mortars, they had put artillery on short pieces of railroad track so that they could wheel it out of their cave and then fire. And then before we could return the fire, why, they would wheel it back into the cave and
Oh,
be
really?
protected
Oh, I didn't know
from our
that.
counterfire. And they had an advantage too. They had developed smokeless powder. We had not. And that helped them tremendously because we couldn't always pinpoint where the fire was coming from.
Yes.
So between the camouflage, the spider traps, the caves, the tunnels, why, they had certainly built, and the smokeless powder, built themselves quite a defense.
Tell me what the spider trap is.
Oh, that's a hole, excuse me, a hole in the ground with a camouflage cover on top of it
I see.
that they could lift and drop very quickly. It was light, and it was almost impossible to see. And when they saw that we got in range, why, they would pop the lid up, they would jump up, shoot, and then jump right back down. And we didn't really know, unless we happened to look in that spot, we did not know where the fire was coming from. And
Oh.
usually they fired from a spider trap at such close range that they either killed or wounded the Marine they shot at. So it was quite effective for them.
And how did they know that there was someone up above? Could they see, or did they have some kind of periscope or something that would?
They would
tip
break,
it up.
Break it like, you know,
yeah, so
break
they could,
it a little bit.
Yeah.
It was kind of pica.
Yeah, so they knew that.
And there was a lot of noise, you know,
sure,
stuff going on, tanks, et cetera. And, of course, tanks were another thing. They drew a lot of fire. And it was nice to have them, and I might have mentioned this, it was nice to have them come up and fire into a cave or a tunnel with their 75-millimeter cannon.
Mm-hmm.
Or with their flamethrowers. Some of them were had cannons with as flamethrowers, shooting napalm into the caves. About 200 feet they could shoot. When they came up to the front lines, we weren't too happy because we were in foxholes. They were inside a tank, and the Japanese were firing at the tank, of course, with mortars and artillery, and we were pretty exposed, except for, you know, being down in a foxhole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was a give and take thing, you might say.
A mixed blessing.
Yes, right. That was about it. But they were very effective when they could get within range. And also, I distinctly remember one tank. It was several hundred yards from me. And he had gone fairly close, maybe within 5-8 feet of a ridge, a little drop off. And from this little valley, if you will, a Japanese soldier jumped up, he was hidden, and he ran to the tank and with his hand placed a magnetic mine on the tank. It looked like a cross almost. It was sort of a homemade. And then he jumped right back down into his concealment. Well, that tank exploded on with that mine and went over down into that ridge. And I honestly don't know if I couldn't get a shot at the Jap that did that.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly don't know how many survived, but it blasted it pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that. They were willing to sacrifice themselves, you know, at any time.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the Bushido code that they lived under. And but that was one example of them putting a tank out of commission.
Mm-hmm.
with a hand, not a landmine, but a hand.
Yeah. Say something about the Bushido code.
Oh, yes. This was a code that mostly the samurai warriors, really. They were warriors, and it was a very traditional way of life,
mm-hmm.
a warrior way of life, lived under what was a Bushido code. And this code embraced the concept that it is a great, great honor to die for the emperor. And they did not hesitate. This was so imbued within their psyche that they did not hesitate to sacrifice themselves, a la the kamikazes on
mm-hmm.
Okinawa,
mm-hmm.
and the charging, the banzai charge at night, screaming and running with bayonets right into our machine gun fire. And they didn't hesitate to eliminate their own lives, which they did frequently, even in caves and tunnels when they knew they were going to be sealed up
uh-huh.
or burned.
Yes.
They would take a grenade and hold it to their, and I might have mentioned this, to their chest and blow themselves up. Or put a rifle muzzle under their chin and take their shoe off and with their toe push the trigger and blow their head off.
Did you see anything like that, or?
Remnant. No, I didn't see him actually do it.
But
no.
The results?
Some results, yes.
Yes.
Some results of it. It was very common on most islands, Tarawa, Guadalcanal, Saipan, Tinian, Iwo Jima, Guam, Okinawa. This really was the Bushido code, a way of life. And if they did not kill themselves, in other words, commit hara-kiri,
mm-hmm.
why they dishonored themselves, their family, their country, and their emperor. And their family would be held in dishonor
mm-hmm.
because they failed to take their life. And we paid a price for this, and regarding the fact that at times our American troops would surrender, particularly to Germans. But there were times, Bataan, and you know, the Death March.
Yes.
On other occasions. And to the Japanese, that was a great dishonor to surrender.
Uh-huh.
And so they were treated terribly and bayoneted and maligned and just killed indiscriminately because they had no use for a military person that would surrender. That went against their Bushido code.
Sure.
They wouldn't do it. The enemy did it, and that was something that gave them license, if you will, mm-hmm. to mistreat them, which they did. On Chichijima, they decapitated some downed. Maybe you read the book, Flyboys, I don't know. But the senior president Bush came very close to landing crash landing on Chichijima. And luckily he got out of his plane, and they picked him up before he drifted into the island. Otherwise, their chances of his living weren't very good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm drifting away from Iwo Jima, though.
Well, but I think what you say about their culture and how deeply ingrained that philosophy is in the Asian culture, that it's part of your understanding of how they would treat American prisoners.
Oh yeah, they had no qualms about torturing or hurting a captured prisoner.
Did you take any prisoners when you were on Iwo Jima?
No. Uh-uh.
There were none to be taken?
It's interesting that you ask that question, because G2 intelligence from division back behind the line sent runners up and said, "We're not getting prisoners. Will you quit killing them and get prisoners so we can interrogate them?"
Yes.
"And get information that will be helpful." And we said, I forget what we said.
Yeah,
whatever. We didn't anymore take prisoners.
Yeah.
We ate steak. Mm-hmm. We killed them indiscriminately. It was, you know, kill or be killed. Mm-hmm. And we didn't take prisoners. Mm-hmm. We killed them. And that's a question I get constantly when I give talks at high schools. What does it feel like to kill another person? And, you know, it's really not hard to answer that, because it's war time. We were trained to kill. We were given weapons to kill. Our buddies were being shot at. We were being shot at. I had no qualms or no remorse about killing the enemy in war, mm-hmm. none whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And most guys I talked to felt the same way.
Mm-hmm.
We threw grenades into their cave to blow them up. Our guys that were flamethrowers shot flamethrowers into the tunnels. And also we used demolition charges to mm-hmm. blow them up. And then later, as we moved on, bulldozers would come up and seal up the cave,
mm-hmm.
just in case we missed some. Mm-hmm. But most of them, I didn't hear them, but a lot of guys heard them blow themselves up with grenades. Mm-hmm. They blew, killed themselves. But one of the things, Anne, that mentioning caves and tunnels was very helpful during the Iwo Jima campaign was the canine corps, mainly Dobermans and German police dogs.
Uh-huh.
And they were very effective in going into these caves and tunnels on routing out the enemy,
mm-hmm.
because they were trained to kill or attack mm-hmm. them.
Yes.
And they were deadly. And those Japanese came running out of those tunnels and came when the dogs got, especially those big Dobermans.
Sure.
I was a coward. I wouldn't get near them.
Yes.
But they really got after the Japanese soldiers. And of course, I remember clearly one day when they, I think there were three of them, came running out, and they were, you could tell they were scared to death. They were running. So, and of course, we, as soon as they came out, they were open, exposed, and we just mowed them down. But the dogs were right after them. They were a very big help, those dogs.
Well, they obviously saved lives. They talk about, you know, yes. as far as many of these dogs in all kinds of service professions.
Yes. Absolutely.
That if a police dog is going to go in a place where some officer has to search, he yes. saves the risk to the officer.
And I guess they still use them in airports to sniff for mm-hmm. Drugs or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
they're just great. They were.
Well, they, now did you have more than one per unit, or did you just see them from time to time, or were there a lot of dogs in the service?
Not to my knowledge. I can't answer your question, frankly, because when we needed them, a call went out on the radio.
I see.
And they would bring up three dogs, dogs with their trainers.
With their
trainers,
yes.
Turn them into the tunnels. Yeah. I honestly don't know how many or how they worked, other than they got them to go into the tunnels.
Did you have a chance to go in the tunnels then after they were cleaned out, or did you see very many of them, or?
Well, we...
You just moved on.
We went into tunnels. I can give you some experiences there. But I don't remember going in after the dogs cleaned it out.
Uh-huh.
But I do remember going in one tunnel, and this is so interesting. I was, looking at everything, checking everything out, and there was, it was, wasn't far from the entrance, and it was a good size cave, really, on the sand floor, and I noticed... And there was still some light from the, and I noticed something on the sand on the floor there. And I reached down and picked it up, and it was a child's crayon set. And I think there were three or four crayons in it, in Japanese, you know, little case. And wait a minute, here in the middle of all this killing, children's crayons? So I kept that for years. I don't know what happened to it. I lost it. But I was amazed at the contrast, you know.
Yes. How bizarre.
Seeing that and not finding somebody ready to kill me or something.
Isn't that something?
It was very, and I never forgot that, of course. That was interesting. And another, this was a tunnel. The lieutenant told me to kind of check it out, clean it out, you know, whatever. And went in, and it wasn't, I could still see because some of it was had let daylight in. There were some holes up there. And I saw cut into the wall a rack, and there were six bottles of sake in there. And I made a mistake and I didn't reach out and grab one. That was the biggest mistake I made. But it could have been booby-trapped too. I don't know.
Oh, I would think, you know, if they left it for somebody, yeah, it might have something worse than that.
Could have been booby-trapped, but I'll never forget. There were six bottles of sake right there within
arm's length.
And I left it there. But we moved on, and those were two cave instances I remember.
That you recall. You
know? Uh-huh. It's quite interesting because of the contrast, you know.
Well, when you would see the Japanese casualties, your estimate would be that they were all young men, or did you see a mixture of all ages, or?
Mostly young. One officer, and he was he had nice uniform, I'll never forget him. He was on a ridge about 200 yards. He had field glasses, map case, everything. Nice looking man, middle-aged, but he was an officer.
Sure.
And I gave him a headshot and knocked him out, down. And I couldn't get over there because we were under fire.
Uh-huh.
But he went down, and I guess that was it. But there was a mix, but mostly young.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember him distinctly because it was a nice shot, 200 yards, you know, with an M1 rifle.
Yes.
You know, and it's 30 caliber. It was like shooting at a fair in a shooting gallery.
Mm-hmm.
200 yards. We were trained to shoot a lot further than that.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But he was looking over the ridge at, I believe, the 28th Marines with his field glasses. And he didn't last very long.
I guess not.
And well, I had no remorse.
Yeah. And so you would clear out some of those tunnels, or mm-hmm. then you'd move ahead and mm-hmm. and go further towards your... You landed down in the south, is that right, mm-hmm. by the volcano?
Right. No,
and then your mission was to move up north, is that...
Cut across the island, which is about 700 yards.
Yes. And you were going east, isn't that right?
I'm sorry.
You were going east across the island? Yes. Uh-huh.
And we pivoted to the right, which turned us north on the other side of the island.
Uh-huh.
And we then separated ourselves from the 28th Marines because they stayed there and then went up Mount Suribachi.
I see.
And that was a regiment that planted the flag.
That's right.
On February 23rd. I was in the 26th Marines. We pivoted to the right,
yes,
and went up to the other end of the island, which terminated in a place called Catano Point. That was the furthest point north on the island, Catano
uh-huh.
Point.
Uh-huh.
But it was a bloody, deadly, bloody trail up there, which is only about 6.5 miles.
And how was it different during the day and during the night?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. During the day, you were certainly trying to survive under fire, you know, catching mortar fire, snipers, machine gun, whatever. And you moved from shell hole to shell hole, or whatever you could find as you moved forward, whatever you could find for some protection.
Uh-huh.
It was, a lot of it was a matter of survival.
Uh-huh.
But at night it was special in that we dug in. And we dug our foxholes when we could. And it was then 2 hours on and 2 hours off with your buddy, foxholes. And that's when we were scared, to put it bluntly, because at night the Japanese were very good at infiltration, and they would infiltrate and crawl along the ground and drop a grenade in your foxhole or ram a bayonet surgery or whatever they could do to kill you. So it was really awfully emotional. It was awfully traumatic.
Stress awfully all the time.
Nerve-wracking at night because you couldn't see the enemy.
Uh-huh.
And that's what was hard. They're out there trying to kill us, you know. Where are they?
Yeah.
Now, true, we did have flares. We had parachute flares that were being fired periodically. Magnesium flares that would produce some quasi-green light.
Uh-huh.
But that didn't, you know, they would freeze when they saw the flare pop and get down flat. So we knew they were coming, you know, snaking along the ground, but we really didn't know where unless we just happened to catch them in a flare. And then, of course, we could throw a grenade or do something. And I'm hesitating there because we hesitated to fire a rifle.
Yes.
Because it pinpointed us.
Where you were.
Right. It said, here we are.
Yes.
Because we didn't have smokeless powder.
Yeah.
So there was a muzzle blast, and then they knew where we are. Now, of course, there were times when we had no alternative, and we would open up. Now, that's infiltration. A bonsai charge is totally different. You know, then you just cut loose with everything you have. 37-millimeter cannon with canister ammunition. What is canister? That's scrap iron, ball bearings, whatever you could throw into the shell that would spread out and kill people. And then at night, they would bring up 50 caliber machine guns on our flanks for protection against a bonsai. And that was kind of comforting to see them up there because those things were deadly.
Yes.
And
did you experience one of those charges?
No. Oh, no, General Kuribachi was adamant. He was going to kill anyone that would start a bonsai.
Mm-hmm.
They were not to do anything but kill 10 Marines before they were killed themselves. That was his order.
Oh, really?
No bonsai. Because he knew from the history of warfare in World War II that the worst loss of life that the Japanese suffered was when they got up and they bonsaied and charged. We had superior automatic weapons and more of them and more ammunition. So we mowed them down. And that's how they lost so many on Saipan and on Tinian. And, of course, on Guam. But they did not, under orders of General Kuribachi, who was an excellent general and quite a poet, they did not bonsai. Now, towards the end, and I have to qualify that, I had already been wounded and left the island, but in reading the history of it, and I read many books on it, towards the end, there was a group of several hundred survivors that did make a charge at tents that were behind the lines, and they pretty well thought it was over. And there were pilots in those tents, a lot of them. And the Japanese did break through. They bayoneted and killed quite a number of
oh, really?
Men and pilots. Yeah. But that was, I believe, the only one I know about that had any size to it as far as a charge bonsai. But no, I never experienced one. And there weren't really, as far as the front lines go, I don't believe there was any. Well, I was there anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Now, intermittently, did you still have air support during period of time? So, you know, knowing your location and that kind of thing was communicated back and forth by your radio people?
That was very important then, yes. Not only radio, but we had orders to put a panel, a fluorescent panel, usually orange or yellow, about from here to the corner over there, and about 3 feet wide to mark our lines, so that when they came down to strafe and F4F and F6F or F4U Corsair, whatever, they would know to stay
beyond
us.
Uh-huh.
And the artillery would, of course, complement them. They were on call almost, other than at night, they were on call almost constantly, mm-hmm. and very, very available. And with their rockets mm-hmm. and bombs, they were effective.
Mm-hmm.
Very helpful. I remember clearly one day I was up on the front lines in my foxhole, and I was looking up, and up there, several hundred feet, not too high, was a grasshopper. I believe that's what they call an LN-4. It was an observation plane,
mm-hmm.
very small plane, one pilot, you know, fabric. And I don't think it was even armed. And the idea was for it to serve as a spotter so that he could radio back targets for the artillery and the naval guns.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was watching him, I was looking up, and boom, he just disappeared.
Oh.
I couldn't believe it.
And you watched the whole thing?
I watched it. There were parts, you know, I couldn't tell if they were body parts or what, but yes, parts fell. He got a direct hit from some piece of artillery, I don't know what. It just blew him. There wasn't much there in that little plane, but whatever there was, it just was gone. He was there and it was gone. It was just pieces falling.
Oh, dear.
Very pathetic. It really was. But those things happen in war, and that's the brutality of war,
mm-hmm.
the horror of war.
Now, at what point and how was it that you got wounded?
We were moving up. I forget the day, honestly, but we had a terrific artillery barrage that preceded, I believe it was about 0800 in the morning. And we were told to move out after the barrage, you know, and smoke had cleared, debris had settled. And we moved out. I honestly can't remember what day it was. I wish I had remembered. And we were advancing. I guess we'd moved up maybe 50-60 yards, and I was moving up with my squad, and then all of a sudden, I was no longer vertical. I was horizontal, helpless. Well, people ask me, what's it feel like to get hit with shrapnel, which is what it was? And I said, I can tell you exactly what it felt like. It was like somebody stood in front of me with a baseball bat and swung and hit me right in the guts with a baseball bat and knocked me flat, because I had no wind, no comprehension, no ability to move or anything.
Uh-huh.
And I was out, and it was, I don't know, a few minutes, maybe longer, a corpsman, and I was conscious.
Uh-huh.
Corpsman came up to me and examined me, put a bandage on my wound, put a critical ticket on me because I was hit in the belt buckle. And he gave me, I'm pretty sure, a shot of morphine.
Uh-huh.
And then after a time, and I honestly don't remember how long, stretcher bearers came up.
Uh-huh.
And put me on a stretcher, bless her heart.
Yes.
Took me back to a big, huge shell hole, which is a battalion aid station.
Uh-huh.
They checked me over there. I don't know what all it did. I ended up on a jeep, stretchers, I think three or four, something like that. Four stretchers on the jeep, excuse me. And I ended up on the beach waiting to be evacuated to the hospital ship. And I don't know how long I was there. And we went aboard a Higgins boat, which was a boat developed by Andrew Higgins of New Orleans, a feisty Irishman that demanded his own way most of the time. But he contributed greatly by developing the Higgins boat, which held about 30 troops, and it was half-inch plywood with an engine in the back and a ramp in the front that dropped, raised and dropped. So I went out to the ship. I was still woozy.
Sure.
And they dropped the cables down, you know, with a hoist and put them around a stretcher, I guess. And
yes.
Up we went. Not me, but all the others that were there on that LCBP. And they looked at my tag and hustled me. I think I've mentioned this. Hustled me directly to the operating room. And the thing I do remember clearly, though, and I've told you this, the doctor said, I want you to start counting to 10. And he took a piece of ball of cotton and laced it with ether and shoved it in my face.
Uh-huh.
And I think I got to 4 or 5. I don't know.
That's probably more than a lot.
So I'm sure I mentioned it to
yeah.
you. But anyhow, that was the extent of it, and some days later, they cut me open and all that.
Do you know in retrospect what any of the reports say? Do you know what was done in the operating room?
No, I
don't care to know.
Not much. They did say I was very lucky. It went in at an angle. If it had gone straight, I probably wouldn't be here.
Uh-huh.
But it went in at an angle and missed the intestinal tract by an eighth of an inch.
Uh-huh.
That was a very fortunate break.
Uh-huh.
And ironically, parts of the belt buckle and parts of the shrapnel are still there in me today.
So you still carry your Marine belt buckle?
Well, not all. Pieces.
Pieces of it.
Little pieces.
Memories of it.
Yeah, but the punchline is, Anne, don't go to the airport with me, please. But from there we went to Guam and to an Army hospital.
Uh-huh.
And I think I mentioned this, I was well treated, and they had excellent nurses, doctors, and did I mention the night I woke up screaming to you?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And I mentioned going to the movies with the Japs up in the cliffs
cheering
clapping for Bob Hope and Bing Crosby.
Well, those are wonderful stories, though, you know, and you think of the incongruities.
It was fabulous. But then I mentioned, I guess, we went aboard a C-54,
yes.
Four-engine plane, and we didn't make it. We went down, two engines failed. And I think I told you that.
Yeah,
Landed at Johnston Island, and then they repaired us, luckily.
Now, were you additionally wounded? I mean, did you have additional injuries with that plane crash?
Oh, no, and it was not a crash, really.
It was an emergency landing.
It was an emergency landing with two engines out.
Yeah.
Luckily, we were on a four-engine plane, C-54. No, it was an injury.
So
but if it had gone down, we were just shark bait. I mean, what could we do?
Sure.
We were stretcher cases. Luckily, the good Lord was looking over us, and we made it somehow.
Uh-huh.
And we went to a hospital called Aiea Heights in Pearl Harbor. Then from there to, and I think I mentioned it, San Francisco. But on the way, we heard that our president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, died. Very traumatic. But I guess I'm being quite redundant here to repeating things.
Not too much. I think, you know, when we decided to go back, why we picked up some of those same details. When you got to the hospital in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
you were at some stage of your recovery.
Yeah.
What kinds of things were they having you do, and did you still need to work on?
They did not start any rehabbing or anything. They examined me, and they said, "We're sending you to a hospital close to your home."
Uh-huh.
And I was put aboard a train, and I ended up in Pensacola, Naval Air Station in Pensacola, Florida.
I see. And then,
because I lived in Miami.
Yeah, and what happened then in Pensacola?
The doctors, who were excellent, examined me, they x-rayed me, and they said, "We're not going to operate on you and take it out. We're going to leave it in."
Uh-huh.
They said, "It'll travel," which it did, but they said, "It won't hurt you."
Uh-huh.
And I guess they were right, because I'm here today. But some of it did travel and traveled out. It came out little pieces.
Yes.
Behind my leg.
Uh-huh.
But from there, I went home and had 30 days leave.
So you went home to your parents' house?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. My parents' house in Coral Gables, Florida.
And they were mighty glad to see you.
I imagine so.
Yes, indeed.
And they fed me well.
Well, that's right. That's what a family is for, to get you beefed up after what you'd been through.
That they did, yes. And I was very appreciative of that. But it was wonderful to be home. And yet, it was sad in a way, and because so many of my buddies and friends didn't make it. And I think I told you, I named my son after my best buddy who died on Iwo Jima.
Did you?
After the war, I went to visit his folks because we made a pledge, a commitment, if you will, and maybe I mentioned this, aboard ship. Before we landed, if you get it, you go visit my folks. And if you get it, the other guy.
Why? Yes.
And we did. We made that commitment, and I didn't go visit his folks.
What was his name?
Harvest McDonald.
And was he from Florida?
Oh, no, from Alabama.
Uh-huh.
And I went up to his farm in Alabama and stayed with his folks for a while.
Uh-huh.
And we came very close, and I went back and visited.
Uh-huh.
I brought one of my daughters over there to visit with him. It was a pretty good-sized farm in Alabama.
Uh-huh.
They, of course, raised their own vegetable garden, raised cotton,
uh-huh.
had corn, and did most everything as farmers do for themselves.
Yeah.
But it was a wonderful family, a large family.
Uh-huh.
And they worshipped their son, Harvest, who
uh-huh.
died. So we became very close, and I got to know them quite well.
Did friends and acquaintances that you had known growing up visit you when you were back home with your parents? Did you see people that you knew or neighbors that had known you were in the service?
Very few. And the reason is, of course, we were at war.
Yeah.
It wasn't over yet.
That's right.
And Okinawa was still going on, and most young men were in some branch of service.
That's
so
right.
So my friends were serving just as I was.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
And, yes.
You know, I really can't remember many at all. Maybe one or two mm-hmm. that didn't go for 4F, you know, didn't
sure.
go for some reason, came by, but not many.
Now, when the 30 days was up, were you feeling like you were back to yourself pretty much?
Yeah, pretty much.
I was
reassigned to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
And went back there and served on the rifle range and helped with the shooting or whatever. And I felt I was back, ready to go back in action if I had been called.
Uh-huh.
But Paul Tibbetts from Florida dropped from the Enola Gay bomb, and we all know, and that pretty well ended it after that, a few days.
Do people ask you about your feelings about that?
Yes.
I bet the students do, don't they, that you talk to?
They do. And my feelings are just about the same. There was no question in my mind, you know, we should have dropped it. They were the enemy. They were trying to kill us. And we were, our plans were to invade the island of Honshu. And my division, the spearhead, 5th Marine Division, was assigned to be the spearhead of that landing. Well, you know that a lot of men would have died.
Yes. And, yes.
Quite possibly. That saved a lot of lives.
Yes.
American lives and our allies. But no, I feel, had no remorse. It was a terrible thing in many ways, but I had no question that was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And there are debates even today by, you know,
yes,
by many that,
yes,
how horrible it was. Well, baloney, how horrible would it have been if a million American lives had been lost?
That's right.
Gosh, so, you know, in balance.
We're going to add?
Well, I was going to mention my buddy and a couple of others were a knee mortar had put a mortar in right in the side of his box hole, and it would have blown, but it was a dud.
Uh-huh.
And we went over and checked that out. But my buddy, is that on?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I didn't know. My buddy, Patrick Petrie, corporal, my foxhole buddy, was a wonderful guy. And he was killed on Iwo Jima. He got shot, and he had experiences at night that really bothered him to be awake and not know where the enemy was, which is frankly fairly common.
Yes.
And he was, I think I meant Chicopee Falls, Massachusetts, where he was from.
Uh-huh.
And he was a good Marine, but it kind of got to him. And he started shaking.
Yeah.
And this was during the day then. And he looked at me, and I looked at him. And I said, Pat, I said, you have to pull yourself together. Because when this is over, you're the guys that we know and we share these experiences with will want to know what you did and how you felt about all this. And he looked at me, and this was in a foxhole, and he said, you're right. He said, this is something that I do need to try to get a hold of. Because I said, he was shaking. And then I heard him a few minutes later talk to one of the guys in one of the other foxholes. And I was so proud to hear that. He told the guy, he says, Gache straightened me out. And I was
really,
I was so proud to have been able to do that for him. But unfortunately, after I left the island wounded, he was killed.
Yeah.
And that's something, though, I remember of him because he's such a good guy.
Well, I have a question about how somebody as young as you were at that time had that kind of mature perspective about looking ahead and how we would look back on those experiences.
You know, honestly, Ann,
how do you explain that? Because I think that's unusual.
I honestly don't know, other than I felt there was a need to do something and say something.
Yes.
And I was just a teenager.
Yes.
You know, and there was something there that made me say those words. And I really can't put a reason to it. But there certainly was something that had to be done because he was breaking up. And it was, I guess, just something that came out. That's all I can say.
And for him to hear it, and for it to make a difference, is certainly a better thing than just taking him out of the line and sending him back.
It was so good.
He somehow could put it in some kind of perspective, and oh, that's a wonderful story.
Well, I felt, you know, I don't know where it came from. I just said it, but I was so pleased that it helped, and that was wonderful. And then the other thing was, I mentioned a knee mortar. Well, that was a small mortar that the Japanese had, and they were good at it. They just put a curved plate against the ground, not on their knee. It would have busted their knee up. But on the ground, we called it a knee mortar because it was
kind of curved.
And they held it by their hands, you know, and they were good at it. And they fired it, just dropped it down the tube. And the guy, I think it was two foxholes over or something, called us over. Fortunately, we weren't under too much fire. He says, "I want to show you something," and he pointed to the edge of his foxhole, and there was a mortar that was only inches from him, and it was a dud. Thank goodness. Otherwise, he would have been in pieces. But I'll never forget that, because I looked at that, and the good Lord was looking over him.
That's right. That's right.
And then, speaking of mortar and close calls, did I mention to you about the grenade fight that I was in?
I think you did.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Fine. Because I can remember that very clearly.
I bet you can.
Very clearly. But there were so many close calls, and that machine gun. Did I mention the Nambu machine gun that opened up?
I don't think so.
I know we were up on, near Motoyama number 2, airfield number 2, and we were in line, and we were told to advance roughly 100 yards or something like that. And I was a rifleman scout, so that was my job, and the sergeant said, "Gache," and I'll never forget it. He said, "Move out." Whoa, on Iwo Jima, you. And I moved out, of course. And you follow orders in the Marines. You're trained to do that. And I started zigzagging, I'll never forget. And I went up, it wasn't much, maybe it was a small amount of sniper fire. And, excuse me, and I went up roughly 100 yards, I'm guessing. And came to the the our side of a ridge, enfilade, and started to took off my cartridge belt, my canteens, and put it just beside me here, and started to dig in a foxhole. Well, no one had come up yet. They were on their way shortly, but I was there digging, and all of a sudden, this machine gun opens up, a Nambu. And I became a rabbit. I went down deeper, and then I turned my head, and he had stitched my cartridge belt and my canteens just inches from me. And I looked at that, and water was hard to get because we were losing too many men to come up front lines. And it's amazing. I got mad. That made me mad. I wasn't scared. I'm just mad that he had the nerve to riddle my canteen where my water was pouring out, my precious water. And it was pouring out into the sand. So I'll never forget that. But then shortly after that, they started coming up digging in. And I found out that was where the whole regiment, the whole battalion, the division formed their line that day where I had started that. Because, believe me, there was nothing out there. But then they kept the line right there for a few days.
Is that right?
Right there where I dug in. Yeah. And it's interesting too. Some colonel, I think it was a colonel, big tall guy, came by one day and he says, he didn't know me. I didn't know him. He says, what's the name of that outfit over there on that ridge? Well, I believe in retrospect it was the 28th Marines had come up. And I stupidly, I said, I don't know. He says, what? You don't know? What's the matter with you? Are you dumb? I said, well, nobody told me who they were. And he stomped off like I was an idiot. Well, actually, he was the idiot because he was standing up in a line of fire and he could have been picked off by a sniper real quick like. But he chewed me out because I didn't know what that regiment was to our left at that.
Oh, dear.
But that's part, one of the things you remember. You know,
yes, absolutely.
But well, what else?
When did you get out of service? When were you discharged?
Oh, at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, right after the war. Oh, I forget the date.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but so it was after the war. They started sending guys home.
Uh-huh.
And as soon as the opportunity presented myself, I said, yes.
Absolutely.
I want to go home.
And so what did you do then?
Oh, I went to work in construction. I wanted to make some money right away, and I did, because you know times were good right after them.
And
there was a lot of.
Did you work in South Florida? Is that where you
mm-hmm.
were?
Miami.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
R.K. Cooper Construction Company was the name of it.
Uh-huh.
And I was an apprentice carpenter.
Uh-huh.
Made good money. Because, you know, there's lots of work, plenty of overtime. Mm-hmm. And then I decided that I needed an education and said I need to go to college. Well, in the interim, I had taken what they called a GED,
uh-huh.
General Educational Development Test.
Yes.
And it was, I was lucky, I got some good scores. And the test gave me what they called a state diploma, state mm-hmm. of Florida diploma.
Yes.
And colleges were accepting that as an entrance mm-hmm. exam. And thousands of GIs
yes.
after the war utilized that medium to get into college.
Yes.
Now, those that didn't pass the test, they had courses set up for them to give them additional
bring
training
them up to
and
speed.
Then
yes.
retake the test.
Uh-huh.
But I was lucky. I didn't have to. And when I started my college at the University of Miami in Coral Gables, Florida,
uh-huh.
and I wanted to get into the business world, so I got a BBA, my first degree was mm-hmm. a bachelor's in business administration.
Mm-hmm.
And then later I decided I wanted to be a teacher and got a master's in education with a major in history. I loved history.
And was that from what university?
University of Miami.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And but in the interim, I been in the reserve, I guess that's what they, and I was called to go back to Korea.
Before we get to that chapter, now along somewhere here, did you meet your wife?
Yes, but it was after the Korean War.
After the Korean,
yes,
so
53. Yeah.
So Korea happened
in 51,
mm-hmm. And you were called up for reenlistment.
I was in Atlanta, Savannah, Georgia, doing electric arc welding on Liberty ships.
Mm-hmm.
Down, I think I told you.
Yes,
that,
you did. We talked about them. Mm-hmm.
And got flashes, and I said, whoa. And I went and joined and got sent to Parris Island, was under quarantine, so I I got sent to San Diego Recruit Depot in San Diego, California. Mm-hmm. And incidentally, I just wrote an article that they're publishing Thursday in the Gator Almar newsletter. It's called "I'm a Hollywood Marine."
Oh, we were talking about that. We were talking about that.
I'll get you a copy of it.
Oh, I would love that. I would love that.
Oh, it's I'll hear about that one. But anyway, I went to San Diego and took my Marine training there. And of course, there's somebody here.
Back of it.
Okay.
All right. But
tell me where.
Yeah, we were talking about you were called to go out to San Diego and
and became a Hollywood Marine. I've never lived it down. Well,
and so what was taking place in Korea then, and what were they? How were things different in their preparation? Than when you remember World War II? How were the weapons different, or the training?
Well, the training embraced cold weather preparations, parkas, capot vest, heavy underwear, long johns, and heavy socks, and so forth. The weaponry and was very similar to World War II. Mm-hmm. We still had the Grand M1 rifle, eight-shot, 30 caliber. We had the carbine. We had the 45 automatic Colt. We had 75 millimeter pack howitzer. We had 61 millimeter mortar, 60 millimeter mortar, 81 millimeter mortar, same as World War II, white phosphor shells, armor piercing. We had 105s artillery, 155. Basically, other than the cold weather gear, it was the same, man. We had an improved bazooka. It was, instead of a, I think it was a 2.6, we had a 3-point-something, which would knock out a tank much better than, of course, the old two-inch one. But other than that, it was
pretty similar.
The armament was basically the same. And we had a totally different battlefield, of course. With the mountains and the cold. And the lack of mobility due to the impediments of freezing and mountains blocking everything. Everywhere there were mountains.
So you left, when you left California, you landed where first?
We landed on a harbor called Pohang. And did I mention to you about the mines and the harbor?
Yes, you did. Okay. You mentioned those.
I knew we were going to be blown up.
And
they were just fishing net.
Fishing nets.
Right. So, but it was quite an experience for this poor Florida cracker, who wasn't really ready for cold weather. And I'll never forget a couple of questions I asked a Korean interpreter. I said, it was so cold, and I had a parka on and everything. And I said, well, when does summer come around? And he looked at me. He said, this is summer.
Oh, oh my goodness. Oh my goodness.
And then another question was, I asked guys, I think they were from Minnesota or Michigan, I forget what. I said, how in the world could you guys up in the northern hemisphere survive every day of your life in this kind of weather? And he says, well, the difference is we could get in out of it. We couldn't in Korea. We were out, you know.
Out in the open.
And you couldn't dig a foxhole because the ground was frozen.
Frozen.
Cold.
Oh.
So we somehow survived with the clothing we had and the armament, but it was mainly, the thing I remember, I'm sure most guys do remember, is the cold that
well,
was
and,
so prevalent.
And did you have problems with frostbite? Were there people who... And I would imagine with all of that bulky clothes on, that certainly decreases your ability to move around. And
it did. We not only had on our field pack, our weaponry, our grenades, our cartridge belt, but we had to carry a sleeping bag, heavy, with an inner liner, plus our shelter half, our tent, half of it. Each guy had a shelter half, half of a tent. And then top of that was a sleeping bag and a poncho. It was quite a pack you had to carry. You're right, our mobility was limited. It really was.
Now, what month of the year did you land in Korea? Do you remember?
Oh, gosh, I wish I could remember. And I honestly don't remember what month. But the 1st Marine Division had just come out of the trap up in the Chosin Reservoir. The worst of it really was over.
That's what you said.
In that respect.
Yeah.
So what we were doing was a lot of breaking up roadblocks, patrolling, opening up roads, you know, that were blocked.
So just some minor skirmishes probably, or were there some real battle?
No, I didn't get in any real, and I'll tell you why in a moment, I didn't get any real battle at all. It was minor stuff, trying to break up an ambush, a lot of patrolling. We did get to ride some in trucks, which was unusual because we're used to walking in infantry. But the reason I wasn't there long enough was I had a bone spur under my knee, and it bothered me quite a bit.
Oh,
and I turned in and the sick bay, and they sent me to Kyoto, Japan. And I was operated on. And actually, they took a chisel and a hammer, as the doctor told me about. I said, "Why?" He said, "We found that's the best way to get rid of a bone spur, is a hammer and a chisel." And that's what they did. And of course, they had given me a spinal. I felt nothing. But then I was there, I forget how long, in Kyoto. And then not long after that, the word came out that guys with points, so many points, for dependents, for a Purple Heart, for service in World War II, number of years, they were allotted a discharge. And I was pretty high on the totem pole, I guess.
I bet.
Because I was only about a year in Korea, and I really didn't do much. I mean, I, you know, went here and there, and we marched and patrolled and this, that, and fought the cold.
Well, did it occur to you when you were sent to the hospital in Japan that this had been your previous enemy? Did that seem like kind of a strange experience? Even though it was probably Americans
it was an American hospital.
Sure.
And the Japanese were very conciliatory. They did not oppose the surrender at all.
No.
And they certainly cooperated. But it was an American hospital, an American doctor, American nurses, and I didn't have any qualms, you know, about that.
That seems like another juxtaposition for you, you know, a little, a little strangeness. So your Purple Heart from the Pacific experience added to your points for
dependence. So I was able to have sufficient number of points to get out rather quickly. So it was only about a year, and I really didn't, frankly, I didn't contribute much. I was there.
I think you probably already had.
So.
And so you got out of the service in what year?
51. I'm sorry. 52.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I had that.
52. Yeah, 51, 52.
And then you came back to Florida?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And somewhere now, here, you met your wife?
Mm-hmm. After that, yeah. Uh-huh. And worked for Bell Telephone for 12 years.
That's right. You mentioned Bell Telephone. What did you do for them?
I was what they call a frame man, to start with, who worked on the wires, setting up what we called, telephone service inside a room called the central office. We would solder all the wires that connected phones to the cables inside the central office.
Uh-huh.
Then I graduated to what they call switchmen, or repaired their equipment, line finders, selectors, connectors, and all that. And then I went to school and became what they called a customer service representative. And drove around in a company car with a briefcase.
Did you like that?
It was pretty nice, yeah. But I decided I wanted to be a teacher anyway. So I finished up my college and became a teacher and taught in Dade County for quite a while.
What level? What?
I started out as a social studies teacher in junior high school. I believe my first class was seventh grade. Then I went to eighth grade. And then I went to Coral Gables High School, taught over there, seniors, world history and stuff like that. Then I received an opportunity to work with interns, and they put me mostly training interns. And one of them happened to be from the University of Florida, so she went back to her professor and said she had seen some things that, you know, were maybe beneficial, I don't know. But I got her a call to come up to the University of Florida and interview for a position.
Oh, so that's how that happened.
Yes, one of my interns, yeah.
Isn't that nice? Mm-hmm. That's a pretty high compliment.
Well, I don't know. Maybe she didn't know any better.
No, no, I'm not buying that.
So I ended up 20 years up here, retired from 68 to 88.
So were you an employee of the university or P.K. Young or both? I guess that's...
P.K. Young's a branch of the College of Education.
That's right.
I was with the College of Education.
Yes.
And I was over there as a media director for a while.
Yeah.
And then, I taught. And I was mostly the media director at P.K. Young, too.
Well, how wonderful.
So I worked with young people for really 30 years. And the good Lord has blessed me because I'm still working with them by going to schools.
Yes.
As a veteran and giving talks on military history. In fact, we just left Bell High School the other day, and we went down
there. I just think that is wonderful.
To the young people about, and answered their questions, really, about military life, World War II, and experiences relative to that period of history.
I have to believe that that's the best history lesson they could get.
It's something that wasn't in their textbooks.
That's right.
They were able to get a taste of firsthand.
Yes.
Excuse me, firsthand information that really came from guys. Not only me, but other guys were there. They came from guys who were actually there and experienced combat with the enemy.
Yes.
And some of them were pilots too. That had been under fire from German 88s there. Famous anti-aircraft gun.
Yes.
So they got a lot of history.
I think that's just wonderful. I think that's just wonderful.
What other questions now do you have that we might talk about, Ann?
I'm going to throw it back to you and see if there are things that you think we've left out or that I haven't known to ask. Have we left out any major chapters?
Ann, I'm trying to remember, and I honestly can't remember where we haven't touched base with some of the experiences. I'm sure there were, but I just can't. It was so long ago, I just can't remember.
Well, I think that we may want to coordinate with Dr. Barrow because we may want to do one more session if you can tolerate this anymore. I'll bring you some more iced tea.
Oh, well, that's called bribery.
I know it is. I know it is.
It works.
And I'm not even ashamed of myself. But I was thinking that we could get some questions together and you could start thinking of stories about your work with the Historical Society and the Matheson Museum and the beautification projects that you've worked with, and the contributions that you and Dr. Barrow were talking about with Alachua County, and we could maybe make that the final chapter. What do you think?
I'll be glad to try to remember whatever I can.
Okay, all right.
My memory is zilch.
Maybe Dr. Barrow and I will have to fight about who does the interview.
Well,
he's certainly more knowledgeable about this than I am.
Well, you do a wonderful job. The thing is, so much transpired. Maybe I told you just the other day we went to a big tree behind North Valletta Regional Hospital.
Yes.
And had a ceremony there.
Yes.
The mayor was there.
Yes.
And all. And the city manager, Russ, and Meg Niederhorf.
Yes.
The,
yes.
City arbor. A bunch of people I knew. Anita Spring, who is now chair of the City Beautification Board. I gave her first job there.
Well, I was going to say you've been here and been involved in the community in so many ways that somehow it just doesn't surprise me that all of those people cross paths with you.
Oh, yeah. We did all through the years. I remember so many of Gary Gordon, the mayor, Jean Chalmers, maybe you knew her.
Yes, I do.
And
I do.
She lives in your community.
She does, and she came over and was part of an interview that one of the graduate students did about the civil rights era. And Jean was, of course, very active.
Oh, yes.
And so she was, I think she was over at Pugh Hall when you and I were going in another direction because I had gone over there in the morning. So, yeah.
Well, she's quite a lady.
Yes, she is. Yes, she is.
Wonderful lady. So astute. And another lady, I bet you know her, who I got to know quite well. In fact, I took a course with her. She retired from the Weimer Hall, professor of communication, radio, TV. I can't remember her name, darn it. I know her. Anyhow, I bet you know her because she lived right in that community where you are.
Yeah, maybe so.
A retired, you know, of course, there's a lot of them there, I'm sure.
Yeah.
She was in the College of Journalism. That was it. College of Journalism. And she lived right there in that area. I guess there's a lot of them.
I think for this track, what I'd like to do is thank you again for your generous stories. And the description is just, it's just miraculous. I think this is going to be just wonderful. So.
Well, I hope it has some meaning to it that may be of some help to someone.
It will. It no doubt will. But officially, thank you, at least for this segment.
Thank you for inviting me. I thoroughly enjoyed
the tea.